You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Good morning and welcome to A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Joining me are Mega. Hi, Mega.
Hello.
And Matt.
Hey there.
And the subject of this summer's episode will be movie psychos. So we brought a few movies for our listeners. Matt, you go first. Which movie did you bring us and which movie psycho did you bring us?
Okay. I mean, since our homework was basically to look at, so to speak, old classic psychos and more modern psychos, the one that popped into my mind right away is the one played by Peter Lorre in Fritz Lang's M. That was the psycho that immediately came to mind because I think he's probably the oldest movie psycho that I could think of, really. There were probably ones before that, but I have to say I don't really know silent movies all that well. And M would have been one of the very early audio talkie movies, I would say. So he's the one that I brought. He's, if you want to kind of have a typology of psychos, he's a child murderer and serial killer. How's that for fun?
So that's a really early movie. So 1931.
Yeah.
And as you say, it's about a child murder. I think it was based on the Vampire of Dusseldorf, who was an actual serial child murdering person.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, but Peter Lorre is obviously more charismatic. So can you just quickly tell me what struck you about the movie now that you saw it again?
Many things. I mean, perhaps let's first start with what struck me other than the psychopath, the serial killer at the center of the movie. It's, I have to say, as I said, I don't really know silent movies particularly well. I think I've seen the occasional scene from some of them. It's also Fritz Lang. I don't know Fritz Lang's movies all that well. I have to confess here, I've never seen Metropolis, which is a big, big, big mistake, I think. I will come around to it at some point. But when I think of the scenes I've seen of silent movies and of Fritz Lang's early films, you think of, you know, German expressionist cinema. You think of Grand Guignol. You think of, you know, very non-naturalistic movie making. It might be called over the top, but I think that's perhaps the wrong perspective. It's films that are very stylized. And I think some of that you also find in the scenes, at least that I've seen of Metropolis, big acting, big eyes, big expressions. It's basically, it's theatrical in a way. And then you come to M, which is, I think, just 2 years later than Metropolis. And it's actually pretty naturalistic at times. It's much more sedate. Yeah, he uses music extremely sparingly. He uses also camera work in a very stylish way, but it's not as stylized. It's not as non-naturalistic. There's almost a documentary touch to this, especially at the beginning, I think, which I think is interesting because I think Fritz Lang was accused by some of the critics at the time of, you know, using what happened in real life, the serial killer Peter Curtin, the Vampire of Dusseldorf, and that was basically tasteless, tacky, and sadistic. But I think in the style that he uses, which is quite deadpan at times, and as I said, there's a documentary element here. It's quite interesting. He doesn't sensationalize, I think, a story that lends itself to sensationalism so much. I mean, you see basically newspapers reporting on this child killer. Big headlines, big exclamation marks. But the film itself does not do the exclamation marks. It does not do the big fat news lines. It's at times a relatively quiet film, and I think that makes it very effective. It's also not what we associate with serial killers these days. And I think that's very much also one thing that drew me to the film. If I think of serial killers and of psychos, I'm sorry, I'm conflating the two of them perhaps a bit. I think of, I'm not going to mention others that we might be talking about later, of course, but I'm thinking of Hannibal Lecter, you know, the criminal mastermind that's fun to watch even though he does horrible things, or perhaps because he does horrible things. I'm thinking of fava beans and all of that. And Peter Lorre's psychopath, and I think we can call him a psychopath, is none of those things. He's childlike. He's pitiful in a way. He's definitely not a mastermind. He is sad and sick, and obviously something must be done about him. But there's none of that cat and mouse game that you usually have, you have elements of that, and I think you have elements of later psychopath movies, but I think it is very much a very unique beast, especially for the time at which it was made.
I agree with you. I personally love all the little characters that like have 1 minute on screen and are like personalities all in themselves. Every little character has personality. I really love that about this film. Mm-hmm. Maga, did you get a chance to see it?
Not that one, no. Well, I've seen it years and years ago. I could probably misquote from memory. I remember liking it at the time. I also remember, yeah, that it was one of a kind, a very strange beast. I need to rewatch it again, but I didn't have the chance.
I can definitely bring you the DVD next time I see you. It's well worth seeing again.
Would be great. Yeah, thanks.
Maga, you also brought us a movie to discuss. Which one did you bring us?
Yes, Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock, 1960. It's interesting in many ways, I think. Hitchcock had finished North by Northwest, which is much more thriller, spy thriller. He decided to do Psycho in black and white because of the blood. He wanted to show some blood. He picked a novel or short story by Robert Bloch. He didn't like the story at all. In his interviews with Truffaut, it becomes clear Truffaut also thinks the story is really not a good one. He also decided to not again do a story about an innocent man wrongfully accused. He sets, in the middle of the movie, he sort of sets a woman who is not prim and proper. First time we see her, she's sort of having an affair with, if I remember correctly, a married man, and she's about to steal a large amount of money and to join her lover with that money. So we are miles away from innocent people wrongfully accused, because the accusations are correct. We see her do it, basically. And then it's 2019 and we forget how sort of standardized stories were 50 years ago or so, because apparently in the 50s and 60s, it was very common if you started some kind of storyline, it sort of ran through the rest of the movie. For instance, there is a policeman stopping Mary and Crane, our protagonist for the moment. We are not sure whether the cop has an inkling whether she has a large amount of cash in her bag. She's sleeping by the roadside. Any other movie would have brought the policeman in much, much more. The policeman goes on watching her exchanging cars at a dealership, and then the plotline involving the cop is sort of over. That was sort of new. If you had a storyline, you sort of had to follow through, and Hitchcock didn't do that. He showed us the heroine leaving the car dealership and then driving to the Bates Motel. And there we meet a sort of strange guy, isn't he? He looks 12 and 48 at the same time. He is sort of a huge man-child. He's towering over everybody. The large taxidermic birds in the room don't help to sort of paint a gentler picture. He's very nervous. He is sort of friendly, but there's something weird about him. He's fidgeting all the time. He has that weird longer dialogue with Marion Crane about being trapped. He says he feels trapped, but he doesn't mind the trap so much because he was born in it. He says weird things like they talk about his mother who is up at the villa and she's sick. And he says a son is a poor substitute for a lover. Very disturbing sentence. It must have been in the 1960s, and it's even now highly disturbing, if you ask me, hinting at very much darker stuff. And then, well, I don't think it's a spoiler. At 48 minutes into the movie, we lose our protagonist, Marion Crane. She's killed horribly with that very famous soundtrack, you know, the violins that sort of tug on our nerves up to breaking point. Someone, probably the mother with a knife, kills her. Wee, wee, wee. Sorry, I have to make that sound, you know. It's like Star Wars fans have to go, brr, I have to make wee, wee. Anyway. And that was pretty much unheard of. You don't lose your protagonist. What do you do afterwards? You are left with the lover, Sam Loomis. You are left with Norman Bates, that nervous kid whose mother has just horribly killed someone out of jealousy. You also have Marion Crane's sister, Lila. So what do you do? What's next? That must have been very, very disturbing for an audience.
Mm-hmm.
So the psychopath here is not only, well, at that point, we still think it's mom, right? At that point, the psychopath is not only to sort of let the audience feel very, very unsafe. It's also a very clever plot device. And Hitchcock knew that. He took a few ingredients and then shook the box, and he wanted to see what the audience would react like. He pretty much said it like that in an interview, in one of those famous interviews with Truffaut. He wanted to make pure cinema. Those were his words. And in order to do that, he allowed himself great freedom. He killed the protagonist. There is a killer on the loose with a knife, although we never see the knife enter flesh. That maybe that's also important. For such a savage murder, there is very, very little blood. And it took the whole team days to shoot that scene. So he was very, very conscious of what he was doing. It wasn't just an in-and-out job for a few days.
Can I just perhaps quickly ask the two of you something there? I mean, Psycho, at the time, as you said, was surprising. I mean, there's the one big surprise that you mentioned, that our supposed protagonist basically kicks the bucket very early on. But there's also another big twist later on. I'm not going to mention it, but I'm pretty sure most people know it. When you guys first saw Psycho, did you know the twist? Did you know the surprise? Or did you go into it pretty much blank?
I had no clue. I must have seen it as a teenager. I was very, very scared. Why do you think I've brought it up today? So, no, it made an impression, definitely. I was fascinated with Anthony Perkins, with his performance as Norman Bates.
Mm-hmm.
He's taller than anyone else. He's living in a house up on a small hill. The house is towering. It's ruling over the motel. It's ruling over the whole valley, over the old highway. It's basically ruling the whole movie in a way. There are dark things up there, which is funny because you associate, you know, dark things with sort of lower beneath you in a way. You know, hell is beneath our feet and not up there. So he is, sometimes he looks like 12 and sometimes he looks very old. And sometimes he looks both at the same time. And he has that weird walk. Sometimes it's purposeful. Sometimes it's just, you know, let's go to the beach or something. He does not have one way of walking. He does not have one way of talking or of sitting. There are many ways. He's never really himself in a way. There is a moment where he sort of dumps the car into a small pond and he's sort of eating something. He has to cover up his tracks or the tracks from the crime he or somebody else committed. And he has the time to sort of, you know, eat something. Why not? So his mind is never really 100% on any one thing at the time. I wouldn't label him a psychopath so much as a schizophrenic. I'm not really versed in the proper psychological terminology, but he is much more a schizophrenic. And a psychopath.
I'd say he's a psychopath. I mean, I think he was based very vaguely and partly on Ed Gein.
Mm-hmm. True.
One of the more sort of famous real life horrifying serial killers. So I think because when I saw Psycho, to answer your question, Matt, I knew most of it. Mm-hmm. What I didn't realize is the impact, you know, of losing, as you say, a protagonist. Who is an incredibly big movie star so early in the film, right? It's a shocker that she, of all people, it's almost an Agatha Christie type move, that she, of all people, is the victim so early in the film. So I wasn't prepared for the impact of that. Of course, I knew the shower scene. I knew who ends up being the actual murderer and the plot twist at the very end. But I think... As far as movie psychos go, Norman Bates has to be a kind of serial killer type weirdo, right? I mean, it's all fiction, but I think he's an absolute psycho with the mummy issues and the Ed Gein vibe and the incestual implications over there. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you think, Matt?
Yeah. I mean, there's, of course, a kind of whole medical discussion here that we can't have because at least I can't say, you know, what is a psychopath according to whichever, you know, book of medical terms. I think I said that basically we've got a serial killer and I kind of conflated that with psycho. Maggie raised the whole issue of, you know, schizophrenic, multiple personality disorder and psycho. I guess it's a question of, you know, what are we talking about when we say psycho? And I think to some extent what we're talking about is we're talking about the monster in a monster movie, but it's not a monster like in, I don't know, Alien or Jaws. It's not something with teeth and slime dripping off it. We're talking about a monster that wears a human mask, a human costume, so to speak. Of course, there's a bigger question here of what is a monster and are these monsters, you know, inhuman? But I think that's if we're talking about psychos as that, as the movie monster that wears the human suit, then I think Norman Bates is definitely a psycho in that respect. But he is, I would agree, he's not a psycho like, let's say, an American Psycho. In the first film, at least, he is not the knowing murderer and he's not the superior murderer. I think that, if I remember correctly, that changes a bit in the sequels. But I only have memories of Psycho 2 and after that I'm trying to forget. What about you, Julie? What do you think?
I think it's interesting that in these earlier films that there's not so much a question of is he or is he not a killer, but there's an issue of morality there. I think they go, if you look at M, they go to great lengths to not portray him as overly charismatic or glamorous. Mm-hmm. And I think you see the same thing with Norman Bates, who, even though he's played by a rather gorgeous Anthony Perkins, they go to great pains to not portray him as a glamorous villain, right? So there is this mm-hmm. thing with the old psychos where there's apparently they're struggling with morality because, of course, these are exciting stories in the sense that these are crime stories and that we're drawn into the mystery of it. They seem to be struggling with, yes, but we can't portray this monstrous killer as a glamorous person, a la much later Hannibal, the Cannibal Lecter, mm-hmm. who is a very, very glamorous, almost an anti-hero. And you don't see that here. These people are portrayed as absolutely sick through and through. So there's the sort of monster aspect to it. I mean, all serial killers are basically sort of the bogeyman in the closet, or the monster between the invisible monster between all these people, right? In the mask is almost invisible, unfindable. But also in a sense, I feel like they're sort of actively portrayed as pathetic in order to not make them mastermindy or glamorous.
Yeah.
You know, that's my sense with, especially with these older movies, there seems to be a rule that you can't portray a serial killer or a child murderer or someone else equally horrible as somehow glamorized.
That's definitely true, but I think with Norman Bates and with definitely with Peter Lorre's character in M, they are pitiful, but pitiful, of course, I think has two components. There's the, you look down on them because they are sick, but I think there's also at least a touch of sympathy for them, probably with, I don't know, with Norman Bates a bit less. There the question comes in of how much do we know going into to the film, and anyone who grew up with The Simpsons will probably have seen at least 25 parodies of Psycho before they've seen Psycho themselves. So they will probably know, you know, what's going to happen to some extent, and they will be surprised that the people aren't yellow and have just four fingers. But I think with Norman Bates, at the very beginning, you feel kind of sorry for him. Perhaps less so once you find out what is actually what, but you look down on him, but at the same time, you feel sorry for him because he's so clearly under the yoke of his mother. He's so clearly, you know, not in a good place. And with Peter Lorre's character, I think you definitely feel some sympathy for him, not for what he's done, obviously. You don't necessarily go into it thinking, ah, oh, he's a poor victim. But there is an element of they're monsters, they're sick, but they're also humanized.
Yeah, I would agree. After I've watched the movie, I was torn about how to approach Norman Bates properly. And I realized that there is a huge pathetic aspect to him. I mean, that guy hasn't gotten over his mother. How pathetic is that? Of course, I'm slightly oversimplifying things. But there is... I remembered when I watched it... when I watched Psycho the first time and I didn't know what was going on, I realized it's... he has disappointed his mother. There is no pleasing his mother at all. And teenage boys very much feel that it is an issue, of course. So you get older, you sort of inevitably disappoint your mother at some point, maybe repeatedly. And then the fear has gone and there's only guilt. And then you can, you know, take the higher ground and say, well, Norman Bates is sort of pathetic. He never got over his mother. But at the same time, there is that very short moment where he sinks the car into that tar pit or whatever that is. The car sinks down and then it sort of stops. And then I realized, oh no, god damn it. I mean, the police is going to find the evidence. And then I realized, hell, you just sympathized with the psychopath. <you know? laughs>
Yeah.
There is not any one point you can approach Norman Bates. You have an inclination to belittle him because... he's a mama's boy. Again, I'm simplifying. And then there's also that moment where you want him to dispose of the evidence. You sort of want him to get away with it because at that point you still think he's, protecting his mother. Of course, that feeds back into what I said first. But it's a more complicated character than we think he is. He is much more complicated than his many... foils later on, where there's a slasher going around slashing people with knives, you know, and there are violins on the soundtrack. So if in doubt, make your Psycho a little bit more complicated than your average slasher movie, because otherwise it's going to get facile.
I'm kind of noticing, Julie, that you're withholding your own Psycho from us. Who is it? Tell us.
I was just going to say that I've also brought a movie... which is one of my, you know, one of those things that come straight from the heart. One of my favorite strange movies is The Night of the Hunter, which is also in black and white. All of ours are in black and white today. It was made in 1955 and is a very different animal from the ones that we discussed previously. Because our psycho in The Night of the Hunter is an actual... knowing, evil person. Also very glamorized. He's played by Robert Mitchum with a great deal of zest. He is a criminal who also believes himself to be a man of gold. He portrays himself as a preacher, but basically is just a misogynistic, serial-killing, money-hungry wolf in sheep's clothing. And the entire movie is about a stash of money that's two little children know where the money is. And Harry Powell, our psycho, hunts them down. And of course, in the end, good triumphs over evil, sort of, kind of. And we get to look at Lillian Gish, being very sort of angelic. So that's my movie. It sort of steals a little bit from German Expressionism. Matt, you mentioned that earlier. It has these lovely images of owls and rabbits and spiders' webs. So I really like the imagery. And I like Robert Mitchum, obviously. So this is one of my favorite sort of psycho movies, because this man is obviously an irredeemable, horrifying, serial-killing criminal. But he's also sort of very charismatic. So this doesn't have the sort of pathetic serial killer vibe that Psycho does and that M does. This one is just an evil man going about his evil business. So I was wondering whether you guys got a chance to see it, The Night of the Hunter, or either of you.
I haven't rewatched it for this, but I've seen it a couple of times, and I think it's fascinating. It's also fascinating in comparison with the other films. As you've said, Robert Mitchum's character, the preacher man, is a very, very different beast, and I think your wolf in sheep's clothing is a great image. I think there is an almost fairy tale quality to the film, also the way it's shot with these two children on the river running away from the wolf. And as you said, you know, he is, I think of the three characters we're talking about, he is the one where you can just clearly say he is evil. No discussion about it. You can say that Norman Bates' deeds are evil. You can absolutely say that Peter Lorre's deeds are evil. It's kind of strange that with him, I keep calling him the actor's name and not the character's name, but otherwise I wouldn't know myself who I'm talking about. With the other two films, with M and with Psycho, there's at least an element of psychology or pop psychology there. You know, both of these are kind of people who to some extent need help because they're sick. There is a pathology there. With Robert Mitchum's character, there's no pathology. He is just plain evil. He is just, as you said, completely immoral or amoral. He just does what he wants in order to get what he wants. And if people are in the way, they get dead.
Maga, did you get a chance to see it?
I've seen it five or six years ago. I haven't rewatched it for the podcast, but I remember Robert Mitchum's performance. Isn't he sometimes, you know, doing a little dance and quoting things, maybe even singing, if I remember correctly?
Yeah.
I remember him enjoying himself in a way that is scary. You know, some psychos scare you because they do scary things. Mitchum has a performance where you think he's sort of leaning over that post, letting us see what he's written on his hand. It's sort of a pose. He's sort of enjoying himself. He's a poser. He's having fun. And regret, if it's there at all, it's in the backseat. It's not tangible. There's no two ways about him. I don't know whether I'm correct. As I said, it's 5 or 6 years ago. But I remember him being gleeful almost.
Yeah, he does have these little... He sings, you're absolutely right, he sings leaning on the everlasting arm. Yeah. So he sings hymns, mm-hmm. gospels. That's absolutely true. And rewatching it, I agree with you, Maga, is that there's a joyousness and a gleefulness to his performance. I think you can almost spot him trying to not scare the child actors too much, right? Because he's trying to be a little bit almost ridiculous. There's a lot of humor. There's a lot of humor there. This is also the character, by the way, I don't know if we've mentioned that, that has love on one hand, four fingers, and hate on the other. That's where that comes from, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is the first character who has that. And he sort of likes saying that love fights down hate and wins. But of course, he is the exact opposite. He's just a very hateful man, but very glamorous, I think.
Mm-hmm. He manages to, you know, absolutely convince Shelley Winter's character in this film. There's, you know, he definitely knows how to fool people, which is kind of strange because I think for us, for the audience, it's clear that he's evil. The music makes it clear that he's evil. There's no doubt about it. But at the same time, there is this very dark charm. It's kind of weird if you think of it that Shelley Winters in this and in Lolita has a very similar role in a way. She's the mother who's hoodwinked by a man with basically twisted evil needs and hungers. And she ends up dead in both of them. And she does this very well. It's kind of sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what you get for consorting with horrifying, murdering men. Yeah, it's strange. Because I think part of the trope of the film, and I think we need that contrast, is that within the film, everybody except the little boy basically believes this guy, right? They believe mm-hmm. he's a preacher when he's just an ex-convict. They believe that he would make a good husband, which he obviously won't because he's a complete narcissist. So we do get this counterpoint in the film that basically everybody seems to believe what this guy says about himself, which is obviously not true. As you see in the beginning of the movie, the prologue where the Bible is quoted, "By their fruits shall ye know them," which is obviously Robert Mitchum's character because his fruits are all bad, right? So we're basically told that he's the evil dude beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
So we need everybody to believe him in the movie.
Absolutely.
So Harry Powell is a very different character from Bates and Peter Lorre. But did you find any sort of links between these three mass murdering, serial killing, mass murdering characters.
You mean other than them killing people, right?
Other than them killing people, yes.
Good question. At first blush, no. I mean, Bates and the Peter Lorre character, if I remember correctly, have at least some kind of reluctance and doubt in them. Robert Mitchum character doesn't. So for the Mitchum character, it's sort of a means to an end. I don't know about Bates. Means to an end, protecting himself? Yes, maybe. I'm not sure about the Peter Lorre character. Does he kill for a means to an end? I don't remember that. No idea.
No, I think with him, it's really he's driven by needs that he can't control. So I think of the three killers, he's perhaps the one who's most clearly defined also by, you know, psychology and psychoanalysis. He's informed by that, I think. There's also talk there about, you know, does he deserve to die for what he's done? Or is he basically ill? There is some of that in Psycho, of course, with this big monologue by the psychologist at the end.
Oh, spare me. Sorry, no. Of course, no, go on. Sorry.
So I think there's also an awareness of the whole, you know, Freud and Jung and all of that in Psycho, but I think it's much less concerned with the reality of psychology than with, I'm not quite sure what, making some kind of point for the fiction. But I think with Harry Powell, there's never any notion that this is a man who needs help. He's very comfortable with what he is. He is the big bad wolf, and the big bad wolf never thinks, you know, I'm sick, I need help, I need therapy. The big bad wolf just wants to rip and rend and eat.
Yeah, it's what he does, isn't it?
And he does it very well.
Yeah,
I think the only one that I sort of... There are a couple of things that stood out to me about what a fictional psycho is, right, in movies. And they seem to all hide in plain sight. Mm-hmm. With M, there's a big deal about how he's unfindable because he's basically an ordinary... He would seem like an ordinary guy if it weren't for this sick obsession that he has. And Bates seems normal, right? At first, yeah, twitchy maybe, or shy, or... But even sympathetic... Mm-hmm. So these, and in The Night of the Hunter, even all the characters in this film believe in that Harry Powell is who he says he is, that he's a preacher. So all these guys, and I think this goes to what our basic idea of a movie psycho should be, is that they don't necessarily register as a dangerous, murdering monster. They register as normal people and they hide basically in plain sight. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Which is also sort of the terrifying thing about Harry Powell, is that he basically gets away with it to such an enormous extent that only the little boy, not even the little girl, only the little boy can see through this guy, right? So these three basic guys, and I think if you look at the more modern movie psychopaths, so not going to psychology, but the trope, these are all people who can hide in plain sight. These are all people who could register as an ordinary guy, as opposed to Freddy Krueger or someone, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You'd spot him a mile away. So that is basically the sort of the link that I found in these films as to what we mean when we talk about movie psychos. We don't mean a psychopath in the pathological sense. We mean someone who looks like us, but is actually a serial killing monster. I mean, do you agree with me?
I think it's a very interesting point, and it's made me rethink something that I've been thinking over the last 10 minutes or so. I mean, in some ways, I think Harry Powell from Night of the Hunter, if anything, he reminds me of, you remember No Country for Old Men? He reminds me a bit of Anton Chigurh in how he's this force of nature. He's evil, he's the big bad wolf, and he's a force of nature. Basically, if you're in his way, you know you're going to get killed, unless you're an old woman with a shotgun, I guess. But at the same time, Anton Chigurh, I think, is not like what you've just described. He is not hidden in plain sight because you can't hide him. He comes in and you know you're dead. You feel you're dead. So while I think there is a line to be drawn from Night of the Hunter to No Country for Old Men, Anton Chigurh is very different in that respect. He never hides what he is. You can't with that haircut, I guess.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
is there. But sugar is also more symbolic, I think. Mm-hmm. I get your point. He's an assassin. So that basically makes him a professional serial killer, to put it bluntly. But he seems to be more of a symbol of the angel of death or demon of death than these guys in the older movies who I don't know why we're so fascinated with pathology, but who seem less symbolic and more pathological, with the exception of Mitchum, who is just having too much fun being the wickedest dude in all the land, mm-hmm. right? So the more modern guys, especially in Sugar's case, are more of a symbol, I think, than an actual character. He's also not basically the main character in the movie. He seems to be an ill omen, right, throughout the movie. He looms.
Mm.
So I'm not sure if I would even categorize Sugar as a movie psycho, per se, as he's not detailed enough. It's like what you, Maga, what you said about Norman Bates, not complicated enough, doesn't have enough sort of character depth to make him an actual movie psycho. He seems more of a symbol.
I see what you mean. I think the point where I would see it a bit differently is probably in the performance, because I would say that Javier Bardem's performance turns him into more than a symbol, perhaps, or at least he doesn't feel like a symbol, even though I think textually he is very much a symbol, as you said. There's nothing there other than the coin that he flips, which basically makes him a Batman villain, pretty much, the silly haircut, and just his sheer presence. This is an unstoppable force, basically. But Javier Bardem, I think, almost makes him into the lead of the film. If I think of the actual lead of the film, he vanishes much more into the movie. If I think of No Country for Old Men, I see Prince Valiant with his cattle-killing gun coming for you, basically.
Yeah.
I only now realize that the actual protagonist of No Country for Old Men, well, one of the protagonists, is played by Thanos, none other than Thanos. So weird.
Yeah, isn't that cool? That is so cool. Talk about your movie psychos. I mean, Thanos has to qualify, right? I mean, if you talk about mass murderers, Thanos is right. Is way up there in the sort of...
Yeah.
But again, he doesn't... I don't think he registers as a movie psycho, mm-hmm. because we expect certain things, very specific things, from a movie psycho, I think. And even I think the interesting thing about ancient movie psychopaths is that even I think M may not register as what we would in modern times would register as a psychopath. He's too pathologized, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think Bates registers because of the mummy issues and the very obvious sort of Ed Gein link. But M is it almost feels to me in rewatching it, it's more about the sort of little characters around Peter Lorre than it's about Peter Lorre. He doesn't even feature in the first half of the film, or almost. We see his shadow looming ominously, but we get to see him play only at the very end. So M seems to me more about what a murderer can do to society, almost Zodiac-like, than the psycho himself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
By the way, the movie Zodiac, one of the strong points of that movie is that it only shows you what it does to a society to have this monster let loose in it without showing the monster.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sort of the anti-Hannibal. Mm-hmm. Hannibal, where we... and I think with movie psycho or psycho films, we tend to focus on our psychopaths, whom we apparently love despite them being horrible people.
Yeah.
And I think Psycho, the Hitchcock Psycho, is the perfect example of this, because we think we have one protagonist, but we end up with the other one, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It must have scared people because there is no center to this movie. And if you want a center, you end up with Norman Bates, and that scares the audience even more. So mm-hmm. yeah. You're not safe with that one.
Have the two of you ever seen any of the sequels, especially Psycho 2?
No, I'm dreading Psycho 2 even more than Norman Bates. No, I didn't dare to. Mm-hmm.
I have to say that, I mean, it's literally been about 25 years since I've seen it. So my movie tastes have also changed a bit, probably. hopefully. But I can actually recommend Psycho 2. I can't recommend anything that comes afterwards, but Psycho 2 does some interesting things, especially with the character of Norman Bates. It's a very different film. It's definitely, it doesn't copy the first film. It also doesn't just do the escalation thing that you so often get with kind of serial killers part 2, 3, 4, 5. I think it's not a great film, absolutely not, but it's a film worth watching if you've got any interest in the genre and in what you can do with the character. It's also got a fantastic soundtrack by Jerry Goldsmith and some great performances, one by Meg Tilly, if I remember correctly. So I think if you get a chance, if you find it for €2 in a, you know, one of those bargain bins, it's absolutely worth getting it just for that.
All right.
Okay, that gives me a nice bridge to my next question, which is, it's a strange question, but as we're talking about fiction, and quite apart from these sort of older movies that we wanted to discuss because they're so seminal for the genre, who is like your favorite fictional movie psychopath ever, regardless of whether it's a movie or a series, and regardless of whether we've already talked about them or are going to in the next episode. Who is your favorite movie psycho? Maga, you go first.
Well, favorite is a very problematic concept. The one that I very, very rarely lose sleep over stuff I watch or read. So it takes an exceptional movie to scare me into insomnia. I have insomnia for various reasons, but not because of scary movies. But one movie that cost me a lot of sleep was Halloween. Michael Myers, there is only a hint of psychology, why he does what he does. And the rest of the movie and the rest of all the other 17 movies about him, he's just relentless. You know, you can't kill him. And he comes and he comes and he comes. That's the stuff of nightmares. There is nothing you can do. You can live on the bottom of the ocean and he's still going to come for you. And if he can't die, he's out there somewhere, you know, still coming after you. So it's you can't have it more simple, as very simple psychopathic characters go. They come for you and eventually you will be dead. And one day that will be true. So it's basically horror in its essence. There is someone out to get you, and he will, period. That's one thing that made me lose a lot of sleep, Michael Myers with that fucking knife. And of course, the William Shatner mask didn't help.
That's a great little movie. The first Halloween is like a wonderful little horror film. I've always loved that one.
Mm.
And as you say, he's a force of nature. He just doesn't, he's like the storm. He won't stop. He won't be killed. Yeah. He will get you.
Absolutely.
In the end.
It's one of the, I think, the purest slasher movies. It doesn't go into this whole, you know, let's make the murders more inventive. Let's make it more fun for the audience. It's really just, it's a bit like the description of the alien, the xenomorph in the first Alien movie. It's basically, it's a killing machine. It doesn't stop. It can't be bargained with. It can't be argued with. It just comes and it kills. I've never dared to rewatch Halloween, even though I've wanted to, because it is so damn good at what it does. It's such a finely honed blade that goes straight in.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite psychopath, Matt?
Which psycho would I invite to my birthday party? Let's see. Well, if the psycho is going to prepare some food and bring it along, it's obviously going to be Hannibal Lecter, but it's not going to be, I don't know, perhaps I'm going to insult movie fans the world over, all of the millions that listen to us. My favorite Hannibal Lecter, my favorite psycho, is not Anthony Hopkins' Hannibal Lecter, but it's very much Mads Mikkelsen's Hannibal Lecter, who I think is one of the most enjoyable and horrific movie psychos. He's very much the psycho as artist, the psycho as director, and the psycho as author. He's the psycho who uses the world as his frying pan, I guess, because his art is mostly cuisine. But he is just so enjoyable to watch, even when you know that what he's doing is horrible. Can I cheat and bring up a second one?
Go ahead.
Basically, Mads Mikkelsen's Hannibal Lecter is very much the opposite of especially Peter Lorre in M. But another psycho that I still like a lot, but I would not invite him to my birthday party, and I would not want to see what he does when he goes cooking, is John Doe in Seven. I think many cheaper, less interesting movie psychos since, let's say, 1995 or so, have always been in between those two, in between Hannibal Lecter, the mastermind who's always a step ahead, and the John Doe, the fanatic, the single-minded, dogmatic. And I think it's difficult these days, sadly, because of who played John Doe in Seven, but I think he is extremely effective because he does not come across as admirable. He does not come across as a Superman. He comes across as a horrible, sick, twisted person who imposes his morality on the world and is sick exactly for that. Yeah, I still find him extremely effective.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
How about you, Julie? Who comes to your psycho birthday party?
Well, I console myself by thinking that I'm not talking about actual criminals here. I'm talking about a figment of somebody's imagination. I'm torn between what we're going to be talking about a little bit later, Patrick Bateman in American Psycho, mm-hmm. because he's, in a sense, he's just hilarious, and it's a very sort of seminal performance. And very unoriginally, Hannibal, the Cannibal Lecter, because Silence of the Lambs, I think, still, after all these years, holds up so well as a little thriller, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the one serial killer is more sort of stylish and sympathetic, just because the other serial killer, this movie has two, is so horrific, is that you can get worse serial killers than Hannibal Lecter in the same movie. I really just like the movie a lot, and I like both performances a lot, and I like people chewing scenery a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I tend to really like that movie, and the guy who plays Buffalo Bill in that, so he's the second serial killer type. I actually did an interview with a FBI, very famous FBI profiler to get into the role, and it shows he's absolutely stunning in it. So these are two of my favorite. I wouldn't want them in my house, but these are two of my favorite sort of movie fictional psychopaths. I think that takes us about time. Next time we will be talking about more modern movies, which should please our listeners, and also more modern movie psychopaths, and they will be in color. Next time, killers in Technicolor. So I'd love to invite our listeners to join us next time. And for now, thank you for listening. And this was A Damn Fine Cup of Culture.